From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Representative Tom Marino, President Trump's pick for White House drug czar, withdrew his name from consideration today after a chorus of protest prompted by Sunday's Washington Post 60 Minutes report laying out how a bill Marino sponsored made it nearly impossible for the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, to stop Big Pharma from selling opioids to bad actors. Yesterday, President Trump said this about Marino.
As far as Tom Marino, so he was a very early supporter of mine, the great state of Pennsylvania. He's a great guy. I did see the report. We're going to look into the report. We're going to take it very seriously.
Well, today, Trump tweeted that Marino told him he's withdrawing. And in that impromptu press conference yesterday, the president also said that President Obama did not contact the families of fallen soldiers, something that's demonstrably not true, and former Obama staffers are calling it a lie. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson has a look at the political news. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Robin.
Well, the Post found that Marino's bill kept the DEA from preventing the sale of opioids to corrupt doctors and pharmacists who peddled opioids on the black market. Wouldn't it have been impossible for this pharma-friendly, you know, sponsor of that bill to be accepted by Congress as drug czar?
Well, that certainly is what the White House concluded. I think the moral of this story is journalism still matters. And at least for government officials below the presidential level, norms do apply and conflicts matter. You saw journalism cause the resignation of the president's Health and Human Service Secretary for taking a lot of private plane flights. And now his choice to head the DEA had to remove himself because he was working against the public interest when it comes to opioids.
Yeah. Well, the president was also asked why so slow on his response to the opioid epidemic. It's been months that he's been in office. Is that criticism going to stick, you know, with his base?
I don't think so. I think the president says we're working on it all the time. They have a task force. He said that next week he's going to actually declare the opioid epidemic a national emergency. So I don't think that this is his slowness or unslowness responding to the opioid epidemic. I don't think that's going to be a big problem for him.
He was also asked why the slow response to the death of four Green Berets in Niger, killed 12 days ago or 12 days yesterday when he was asked. And this is, again, during this news conference. He said letters had been drafted and he planned to make phone calls to the families of the four Green Berets. Again, it had been 12 days. Then he said this.
The traditional way, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls. I like to call when it's appropriate, when I think I'm able to do it.
And later he was asked by reporters to clarify, did he say that President Obama, when Commander-in-Chief, didn't honor the fallen by contacting family or being there? Let's listen.
President Obama, I think probably did sometimes, and maybe sometimes he didn't. I don't know. That's what I was told. All I can do is ask my generals.
Mara, that's a serious charge, saying that a president didn't contact families of fallen soldiers.
Pretty serious. And the president went even further today in a radio interview. He said, you can ask General Kelly. Did he get a call from Obama? So he was.
Oh, we should remind people that General Kelly lost a son.
Yes. General Kelly, the chief of staff, is a Gold Star father. He's extremely private about the loss of his son in 2010 in combat in Afghanistan. And the president's first reaction yesterday was to stick it to Obama. And his reaction today was to do it again. We don't know what Kelly feels about being drawn into this fight that the president has started with President Obama about who's more patriotic, who's better to Gold Star families. We do know that the White House says that Kelly never got a call from Obama. We don't know if President Obama reached out in other ways. We do know that General Kelly and his wife were at the White House in the spring of 2011 to attend a Gold Star family breakfast where they sat at the table with Michelle Obama. But this has gotten, as you said earlier, a really strong reaction from Obama officials. Former aide Alyssa Mastromonaco called the claim a lie and said that the President Trump was a deranged animal.
Well, Eric Holder tweeted out a photo of himself and Obama greeting the returning bodies of dead soldiers. And when you said Master Monaco called it a lie, she called it an expletive lie. I mean, pretty impassioned response here. Others are saying, don't be distracted. The real question should be, why hasn't the president commented on Niger and the fact that four Americans were killed there? So others
are gonna... clearly was sensitive about that criticism that he waited too long. In the 12 days since they were killed, he was able to go after the NFL, go golfing a lot. In other words, he clearly sensitive about this. And when he's criticized, we know he tends to lash out. And that's what he did.
NPR's Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, homes have been evacuated in the Santa Cruz Mountains of California because of a new fire that has broken out. Firefighters in other areas of Northern California are beginning to see some progress, with many fires partially contained. At least 41 people have died, and the fires have destroyed thousands of homes and businesses. Firefighters have been working nonstop, battling the flames, including inmates in the California prison system. Nearly 4,000 incarcerated men and women currently work in the conservation camp, a voluntary program co-managed by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation and the Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, known as CAL FIRE. All of them are deployed in the effort to stop the fires burning across the state. Nina Gensler-Debs of KALW spoke with two inmates battling the Tubbs Fire in Sonoma County.
Michael Drabon's firefighting crew was in trouble before they even reached the fire.
Some trees had fallen into the road, so we stopped to clear the tree out of the road.
They were only there for 10 seconds when a giant pine tree snapped.
Somebody yelled, "Look out," and everybody scattered, and the tree came down and actually hit a CAL FIRE truck, hit a CAL FIRE captain, and then hit one of the crew members on my crew, actually. And everybody was okay, but they barely dodged losing their lives.
Those 10 seconds were Drabon's inaugural moments of his very first fire. It only got worse from there.
We just drove through devastation of just houses burned to the ground and people scattering everywhere. It kind of feels like you're right in the middle of, you hear as a kid what hell is like. That's what it reminds me of.
Drabon and his crew have been fighting the Tubbs Fire in Santa Rosa for days. When I talk to him, he's resting after a 24-hour shift.
Yeah, it's my first time being out work straight for that long, so yeah, I was pretty tired.
Inmate firefighters are trained to create a containment line, meaning they're often out ahead of the fire, clearing brush and trying to stop the flames from spreading. But they go where they're most needed.
We're all prepared for this, so they make sure we're all ready to go at all times.
They work in crews of about 12, and everyone has their own role. Drag spoons are the medics. Swampers help the captain look at maps. Sawyers and polers cut down and remove shrubbery and other plants. Drabon is a Pulaski, named after the axe-like tool he uses to chop down stumps and scrape the ground clear.
It's hard. It beats you up. For me, it wore me out. I'm 37, so I'm not a spring chicken.
Even though the work is grueling, there are many reasons why people sign up.
What'd you have for breakfast this morning?
We had scrambled eggs, potatoes, yogurt, some berries.
Solomon Shoemaker says the food in the camps is one reason. It's a lot better than the food in a regular prison. You get good exercise. Plus, you're not actually in prison.
I wanted off of the yard, I guess you could say. And this was a good opportunity for me. To do that.
Another benefit that the California Department of Correction and Rehabilitation likes to highlight is that this is the best paying job in the prison system. While at camp, so not out in emergency situations, inmates get paid $2 a day. On the fire line, they get paid $1 an hour as they work alongside and under the leadership of CAL firefighters. Because of a section of our tax code, prisoners' work isn't considered legal employment, so we don't have to pay them minimum wage. CAL firefighters who aren't incarcerated can make up to $100 an hour. But Shoemaker says there's a camaraderie among all of them.
They're all used to seeing us out there, so they're really cool with us. And they don't really treat us any different than they would their regular firefighters. So that's kind of nice.
This time of year is busy for firefighters. Before coming here, crews worked near the Oregon border, subduing flames that burned for weeks. Shoemaker's fought a lot of fires, around 100, he guesses. But this fire, it's different.
It was worse than I expected by far. And that's when I kind of, you know, everybody kind of just got quiet on the bus and just was looking out the window like, wow, you know.
These wildfires have strained California's resources. Some incarcerated firefighters are working 48, even 72-hour shifts. But both Solomon Shoemaker and Michael Drabom say it's worth it. Here's Drabom.
A couple was driving by and they stopped and the guy rolled the window down and he just started thanking us. And it wasn't 5 seconds, he was crying. You know, this guy was probably in his 50s or 60s, and I don't know what he lost or what he was possibly getting ready to lose, but he cried, you know, and he thanked us and he drove off.
When he gets out of prison in a few months, Drabom's considering becoming a firefighter full time. But for now, he's going back to his tent to get some sleep before heading out for another 24 hours of fighting the flames. For Here and Now, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs.
The hashtag MeToo was first launched by a young black woman, Tarana Burke, 10 years ago, picked up by actress Alyssa Milano this week, and is now being used by millions of women to tell their stories and show solidarity with the more than 24 women who've made charges against movie mogul Harvey Weinstein. They're also, in effect, supporting this woman.
And hi, everyone. I'm Gretchen Carlson. So what is the real story? Well, it's my
former Fox News host and former Miss America Gretchen Carlson filed a successful lawsuit against Fox News CEO Roger Ailes, in which she said she was fired for rejecting his advances, including his constant suggestion that they should have sex. It would make them better. He ultimately resigned and died in May. She won a $20 million settlement, but was excoriated on social media. Her new book is Be Fierce, Stop Harassment, and Take Your Power Back. And Gretchen Carlson joins us. Welcome.
Robin, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So I got to start with Harvey Weinstein. When you first heard, what did you think?
I wasn't surprised. I can tell you that as horrific as the revelations were, and my heart goes out to all the women who suffered, I at the same time felt immense optimism that we're finally reaching the tipping point. We're not going to take it anymore once and for all. And it just really showed me that women were starting to be willing to put their names and their faces to this issue. It wasn't just all anonymous reporting. And that is such a huge, huge step in trying to win this battle.
But we had that audio tape come out from a sting that wasn't followed through on. Feels to me like sexual harassment is the wrong phrase. It's not harassment, it's abuse, and it's not sexual, it's violent. Let's listen to a little of the audio. And now to set the scene, there's a model standing in a hallway, and Harvey Weinstein is trying to get her into his hotel room. Let's listen.
If you embarrass me in this hotel,
I'm not embarrassing you. It's just that I don't feel comfortable.
Honey, don't have a fight with me.
It's not nice.
Please, I'm not going to do anything. I swear, my children, please come in. On everything. I'm a famous guy.
I'm feeling very uncomfortable right now.
Please come in now. And 1 minute. And if you want to leave, when the guy comes with my jacket,
you can go. Why yesterday you touched my breast?
Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
But are you used to that?
Yes, come in.
No, but I'm not used to that.
I won't do it again. Come on.
Gretchen Carlson, that's violent.
Well, that is so true. I've had, you know, occasions in my life before what I experienced at my most recent employer where I didn't even call those experiences assault until recently. Mm. I think this is something that women think that we can get through. We have an experience. We power through it. We forget about it. We stuff it deep down and we just keep moving on and working harder. And I can't tell you the thousands of women that I heard from when my story came out from every profession where it suddenly became a part of the national dialogue again, and they wanted to tell someone, and they chose to tell me because they knew I got it.
You mentioned things have been anonymous and people have been shamed, but also people have been forced into silence, which is the title of one of your chapters, Mandatory Arbitration. There's a lot of calls now to get rid of this because many of the women who accused Harvey Weinstein were under contract. They were forced into a certain way of dealing with this. Explain mandatory arbitration.
Forced into secrecy is what it's all about. So the way in which our society has chosen to handle sexual harassment cases is one of two ways predominantly. Either settlements, where the woman does not work for that company anymore and the perpetrator in many cases can stay, and then she's gagged from ever speaking about what actually ever happened to her, or by mandatory forced arbitration. These clauses are becoming prevalent in employee contracts. I encourage everyone to look at their contract to see if they have one. I bet you don't know if you even do, but you should. Because what this does is takes away your Seventh Amendment right to an open jury process if you happen to get into a dispute at work. Fact of the matter is, hypothetically, if somebody's sexually harassed and they have this clause, they file a complaint, and guess what? No one ever knows about it. Only 20% of the time does the employee win. The depositions are different than an open jury process, so are witnesses. There are no appeals. We must change the way in which we choose to resolve sexual harassment cases in this country. And that is why I've become so active on Capitol Hill to try and get a bill passed in a bipartisan fashion.
Well, and you've said that after Harvey Weinstein's story became public, and many on the right pointed to those on the left for not being quick enough to condemn him. This is nonpartisan.
Well, that's 100% true. When somebody decides to harass you, they don't ask you what political party you belong to before they do it. I am very optimistic, Robin, that I have been meeting with Republicans on a private level, and I am optimistic that I will get a Republican to co-sponsor this bill. Because, listen, unless I get both sides, it's not going to pass. And then it's going to go up to Donald Trump, and we will see what the president will do with this bill.
Well, let me ask you about that. As you write, historically, Republicans have not been in favor of rescinding these arbitration rules that, again, a woman might get a settlement, but then she's not allowed to talk about it. And one of the problems there is, and then there's no record. We don't even know how many of these cases there are. Problematic there, but she doesn't get to tell other women about this predator in the workplace because she can't. But you mentioned you're trying to get Republicans behind this, and you just mentioned President Trump. And you were an anchor at Fox News when President Trump was discovered on his own audio tape saying just some of the same things Weinstein said. Weinstein said, "I'm famous, I can do this." Then reality TV star Donald Trump said, "I'm famous, you know, I'm a celebrity, I can do this." And it was Fox News that tamped down criticism of that. It was Fox News and Roger Ailes that could be seen as protecting Donald Trump then and for decades earlier, for instance, during his false birther claims against President Obama.
I had already had my career ended for me at Fox News when that tape came out. Mm. I had already filed my suit on July 6th. The tape came out, I believe, in October later that year. And what I will say about the tape is that I showed it to my children right away. They're 12 and 14 because I wanted to use it as a teachable moment to show how you don't treat women. Mm. And here's the message that I have said about that tape ever since the day it came out. And that is, I don't care what political policy you agree with or disagree with on immigration or tax reform or anything else. Human decency supersedes any political policy.
But I meant more you were part of a culture for years. There was reporting starting in 2013 about corporate objectification of women at Fox, NPR's own David Folkenflik, the media critic, who also wrote Murdoch's World, told a media panel there's a camera that they have at Fox, and what they do, I'm told this is absolutely true, they sort of sort the women they have by the degree of attractiveness, and particularly the degree of attractiveness of the legs. People who have gone on as guests talk about how they get all dolled up in the makeup room and they're told the shorter the skirt, the better. And you couple that with a leg cam is what it's called. You were part of that culture.
I know, Robin, and I wish I could talk about my time there, but rest assured, I have always been a supporter of women. Going back for decades, I had great female bosses along the way, as well as men. I have made it a point of my career to reach out to women. So I wish I could comment on that, but I think that what...
You can't.
I think what I'm trying to change, but I think it speaks for itself. I will say that I went to Stanford University. I studied at Oxford. I was valedictorian of my high school class. I'll just leave it, you know, at that and let the rest speak for itself.
Well, it'd be interesting to see now, as Megyn Kelly followed you and others have as well, if that culture and that look, if it changes. You want to make so many changes. Can you tick off some of the things you'd like to see happen to create change?
Well, first and foremost, we need men to help us, and I dedicate an entire chapter to men who are already defending women. Look, most men want to have a safe work environment for all women. There's also a chapter on parenting because this starts in the home. Being fierce in life starts when you're bullied in elementary school. It starts when you're sexually assaulted on a college campus. It starts when you're not paid fairly as a woman when you get into the real world, when you don't get a seat in the boardroom, and when you don't get the promotion you deserve. This is a rallying cry, and I think we're in this time right now where women, we feel we have a voice.
Do you think so, though, really? Because,
mm-hmm,
you know,
there
are women. I mean, one of the reasons that women haven't spoken out, they can't in some cases, as you can't now because of these arbitrations, you'll lose your job. You lost mm-hmm. your job.
Right. And that was the gnawing question that really troubled me after my case when I started hearing from these thousands of women across the country is, how can I help the single mom working two jobs, trying to raise her kids in the best way she can, and she's being sexually harassed at work? That is why I started the Gift of Courage Fund, where I am financially supporting organizations that are empowering girls and boys. And the offshoot of that I've just announced is the Gretchen Carlson Leadership Initiative, which is a 9-city tour for underprivileged women where they can come for free and learn about getting lawyers for sexual harassment, learn about domestic violence, and learn how to be civically and politically involved. Because when you become a victim of domestic violence or sexual harassment, you feel like you don't have a voice on that front. But you also feel like you don't have a voice in any other aspect of your life. And all the proceeds, by the way, of my book go back into the fund so that it's a circle. In other words, I keep helping women over and over again and empowering our girls and boys to learn how to respect females so that when they get into the workplace, we don't see this happening over and over again.
That's Gretchen Carlson, a former Fox anchor. Her new book, Be Fierce, Stop Harassment and Take Your Power Back. Gretchen, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
For the first time ever, astronomers have caught a glimpse of the cosmic fireball from two dead stars colliding. One scientist called it the greatest fireworks show in the universe. The massive explosion called a kilonova happened 130 million light years away, not too far to be observed by scientists here on Earth. The Gravitational Wave Observatory, known as LIGO, made this recording of the event. Listen very closely. Let's bring in NPR science reporter Nell Greenfield. Boyce, Nell, that little blip, people could hear it. It sounds so benign, but it represents a cataclysmic event in outer space. What are we hearing exactly?
So those are gravitational waves converted into sound waves, okay? So ripples in space-time that have been transformed into waves that we can hear. And that is the sound of two neutron stars colliding. Kaboom.
And it happened on August 17th, right? And within hours, it became one of the most documented celestial events in history. Thousands of scientists around the world recording it simultaneously.
That's right. And they're all publishing papers on it this week. I mean, these papers have thousands of authors. This is considered to be one of the biggest events in astrophysics, maybe ever.
How did they all observe it?
When these neutron stars collided, it sent these ripples moving through space that have finally arrived at Earth. And at about the same time, a NASA satellite saw this flash of light, a gamma ray burst. And so immediately everyone was like, whoa, something big has happened. And a bulletin went out to astronomers all around the world telling them where in the sky it came from so they could point their telescopes there. Hmm. And almost immediately they found it. It looked just like a new little point of light in the sky that was blue and then turned to red. And what they were watching was this unbelievable fireball.
Now, scientists have long thought that these kinds of explosions are the source of many of the heavier elements in the universe, including gold and silver. Can you explain that for us?
Right. So you may remember from physics class that elements are forged in stars. The thing is, scientists had thought that in stars there wasn't enough energy to make the heavier elements, things like, you know, gold and platinum and uranium. And so it had been theorized that two colliding neutron stars are these very dense objects, the size of a city, but with more mass than our sun. When these two things slam together at a third of the speed of light, they thought that this could send out like a shower of platinum and gold. And that's basically what they got to watch happening here, something that had only been theorized. Now they could watch it unfold in almost real time.
And what else can scientists learn from this event?
Boy, I mean, they can get so much. They can come up with a new estimate for how fast the universe is expanding. Gamma ray bursts that this thing gave out, those are very mysterious. People haven't really understood where those came from. There's kind of like something for everyone. Almost, you know, a third of the astronomers in the world were all watching this thing. It was like a huge party for astronomy.
Now, Nell, this is maybe the third time in the last month that we have been talking on this show about LIGO. It is really having a moment right now, these detectors that they have to detect the gravitational waves.
That's right. So Albert Einstein predicted that gravitational waves should exist. And it took researchers decades to figure out how to make massive detectors that could actually sense these little shifts in space. And then this month, the folks who founded LIGO won the Nobel Prize.
Right.
And this example of catching neutron stars in the act of colliding just shows how powerful this technique is. Because if they hadn't sensed those gravitational waves, they just wouldn't have seen it at all.
Just amazing. NPR science reporter Nell Greenfield-Boyce. Nell, thank you.
Thank you.
The Republican proposal to overhaul the tax system faces a key vote this week as senators will consider a budget bill needed to advance the plan. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is facing a lot of pressure from President Trump to get the job done. The framework tax overhaul aims to spur revenue by cutting taxes for American businesses and earners, including the wealthiest. And it's part of the Republicans' long-held belief in supply-side or trickle-down economics. Arthur Laffer has been called the father of supply-side economics. He advised President Ronald Reagan and the Trump campaign, among others. Now he's founder and chairman of Laffer Associates. Arthur Laffer, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm quite a fan of the show.
Oh, well, thank you. And by the way, you're also, it sounds like, a fan of the Republican tax overhaul plan. So,
oh, I am.
So tell us why.
Well, because it cuts the corporate rate from the highest in the OECD to about the middle of the pack, a little bit below the middle, and that will bring jobs back to the U.S. It'll increase output, employment, and production. But even more so, Jeremy, what it'll do is it will reduce the amount of tax sheltering that businesses do. There'll be less tax evasion. There'll be secondary and tertiary revenues. There'll be all sorts of things happening at the state and local level that will be really impressive and help the country a lot, I believe.
Are you worried that it will add trillions of dollars to the deficit?
No, not at all. In fact, just the reverse. Any serious model tells you that economic growth always leads to increases in revenues, not reductions in revenue. But, and this bill will, according to some of the models, raise about $1.3 trillion over the next 10 years if it's passed.
But we know that the Bush tax cuts did not pay for themselves. So why would we think that this time it would be any different?
Well, Bush did a lot of stuff that wasn't tax cuts. They weren't marginal tax rates as we're looking at here. In fact, most of Bush's tax cuts were not marginal. They were inframarginal and just added to the deficit. What's happening here is by cutting the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%, that really adds an incentive structure there that will cause the economic growth. Last time we did the corporate rate was in 1986 when we dropped it from 46% to 34%. And of course, you know the huge growth in the late 80s that all of that engendered.
Well, but the national debt also increased after the Reagan tax cuts by 190%.
Yes, and they did that much for Obama as well. I mean, if you look at any administration over any period of time, only the Kennedy and the Clinton years did they have surpluses at the end of their period. All the rest had increases in deficits.
You've talked a lot here about the corporate tax cuts. Is that, in your view, the more important part of this tax overhaul?
Oh, yeah. It's the heart and soul of this plan. So today, we have a 35% federal marginal tax rate. We are the highest in the OECD, which is 34 countries. Now, back in 2000, we had the same rate that we do today. But back then, we were the seventh highest, and every single country in the OECD, with the exception of the U.S. and Hungary, have reduced their tax rates, some of them by a huge amount, like Germany and Japan have dropped them a huge amount. And correspondingly, they've gotten the jobs, they've gotten the companies, and we haven't. And if we just drop it back, I think you'll find a lot of movement back. It's really very simple. If you have a lower tax rate, people will move into your region.
How do you respond to the argument that many are making that this tax overhaul plan will really be a benefit for the wealthy and not the middle class?
Well, I am really hoping it's a benefit for everyone. I mean, to me, the key here is economic growth. I hope everyone's tax rate goes up because they get a much higher paying job or they get employment that they otherwise would not have had. And I have nothing against the wealthy. There's nothing wrong with being wealthy. The problem in America is there's something very wrong with being poor. And what I'd like to see is those poor people get good, high-paying jobs that they otherwise would not have had.
But not all the poor people in America are going to get good, high-paying jobs, no matter what the tax rate is.
Of course not. But if we save 11 million of them, wouldn't that be great? I mean, if we just got the employment to adult population the same as it was when Clinton left office, if we just did that, we'd add 11.5 million people employed in the U.S. And that's something well worth a bill like this.
So why not just leave the top tax rate at 39.6%?
Because the top tax rate is a disincentive for people as well. And by the way, you don't get the money from those people. They just find tax shelters and loopholes and dodges. And if you lower the highest tax rate, you will find these people paying their taxes instead of doing all that other counterproductive stuff. And it's very clear in the records.
Do you have any concerns about the idea of doubling the standard deduction? There are some who believe that that will make the mortgage interest deduction irrelevant. It'll hurt the housing market.
Well, getting rid of the standard, doubling the standard deduction, I don't see how that would do mortgages at all. But let me just say that what would happen there is that would increase the deficit. Now, its side effect is it would take a lot of people off the tax rolls, so they wouldn't have to pay tax, they wouldn't have to pay filers and all that sort of stuff. But bottom line, I would like to see every dollar of income taxed at the lowest rate all the way across. I'd like to see us do Jerry Brown's flat tax of 1992, where everyone pays the same rate on everything they earn with no deductions, no exemptions, no exclusions. That's what I'd really love to see. But this bill does not do that. It doubles the standard deductions, which I would oppose if I were to nitpick on it.
What about the estate tax?
State tax is, again, another one. The really rich people don't pay that tax. They have all sorts of shelters and ways around that tax, and they have had for years. If we lower that tax rate, it means you just won't have to hire all those lawyers and accountants. And some of these people will actually pay their taxes and not move.
But if we were to do all the things that you're talking about, aren't we just going to end up with not enough money to pay for the services that people expect at this point in the United States?
Well, we're going to have deficits whichever way we go. I mean, let's just be serious about that. But the important thing here is that I believe this will reduce deficits substantially over the coming 10 years because of economic growth, number one, and also because people will no longer shelter or not shelter as much their income. There'll be less tax evasion. There'll be more companies coming back to the U.S. just for headquarters. There'll be lots of secondary, tertiary, and quaternary effects that really will offset it. If you look at when we had the biggest surpluses, it was always following tax cuts and pro-growth policies as under John F. Kennedy and under Bill Clinton.
Do you think that any tax cuts should be put into a package along with big spending cuts, though, in order to try to deal with some of the deficit issues?
I would love that. I really would. I don't think that's in the cards this year, but I sure as heck hope it is in the cards in future years. We have a lot of spending we really don't need to do, and I would love to see that brought under control.
Why do you think that the tax system has lasted as long as it has since the last time it was overhauled back in the 80s?
Because of complacency and because of people just not understanding this tax system. I mean, if you look at Warren Buffett's taxes, for example, in 2010, he said he paid $7 million in taxes, had taxable income of $40 million, and adjusted gross income of about $62 million. And yet, as an economist would calculate his income actually was about $12 billion. He paid less than 1% of his income in taxes, according to an economist's definition of income. And that's outrageous. Now, he did it all legally. There's nothing wrong, but we have to get rid of all these loopholes. I'm all for taxing the rich a lot more. But the way you do that, Jeremy, is by lowering tax rates, not by raising them.
Are you really in favor of taxing the rich a lot more?
I'm in favor of collecting the taxes I believe they should pay. Yes, I really am. I would love to see a flat tax in this country because they are using all of these gimmicks and tricks. And everyone who knows taxes well, just ask your corporate accountant and you'll see just how they do it. I mean, contributions. You don't have to pay taxes on the unrealized capital gains on contributions to NPR and all the other 501c3s. Likewise, you can make that contribution and get it fully, 30% of your income can be used as a deductibility for it. So, you know, you're not really giving your money. You're giving a lot of taxes when you give it to the 501c3s. And that's about $430 billion a year just to 501c3s.
So if there's a member of Congress or a member of the Trump White House listening to this right now, as they iron out the details of this tax overhaul plan, is there something you would like them to change based on what you know at this point?
I wish they had gone down to 15% on the corporate tax. I would like to see that we went from 7 brackets to 3 back brackets, which is great. But in 1986, we went from 14 brackets to 2 brackets, which was spectacular. And look at the growth we created in the 80s. I mean, it was wonderful. And it led to really helping Bill Clinton produce a wonderful economy with a lot of prosperity and ultimately running budget surpluses as he did.
That's Arthur Laffer, who is former economic advisor to President Reagan and to the Trump campaign, now founder and chairman of Laffer Associates. Thanks for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you.
And now a question. Do you smother your cauliflower with cheese and then bake it? Broil or boil your broccoli and serve with olive oil? Well, back away from the stove, because here now resident chef Kathy Gunst has a better way. She joins us in the studio. Kathy, first of all, these are very much better ways. But
I hope.
Cauliflower and broccoli, why?
Well, it's actually the time of year. We do see cauliflower and broccoli in the market year-round because we live in a year-round kind of vegetable culture. But the truth is that they are in season now, particularly broccoli. It's called a cool season crop, and you'll see it from October straight through the spring in April. And cauliflower as well. In farmers markets, you'll see beautiful little heads of cauliflower with bright green leaves. That's a sign that it's very, very fresh. And that's what you want to be looking for. And the possibilities are endless.
And do you see cauliflower, by the way, as a main course?
That is so personal, Jeremy.
This one could be.
You know, absolutely, it can be. There is something very, and I'm sorry to use this word because I know vegetarians don't like it, but it's almost meaty. It's very substantial. The first dish I want to turn your attention to is a whole roasted cauliflower. Mm. So I took a whole cauliflower, again, the bright green leaves, and I roasted it with just some olive oil and salt and pepper. And then in a skillet, I sauteed some garlic with some olive oil and pine nuts and parsley, spooned it onto the roasted cauliflower, and then sprinkled a little bit of Parmesan cheese for some umami, that fifth sense, that, again, a meaty flavor. I could eat that alone for dinner. So, yes, I will answer your personal question. Absolutely.
By the way, these are of the cruciferous vegetable family.
Well said. Cruciferous. Can I say it? Because I practice.
Cruciferous.
I don't think
now
I could spell it.
That.
Okay,
yeah.
I could, but it's boring. Yes, broccoli and cauliflower are both cruciferous, as are cabbage and kale. Unlike the others, cauliflower has no chlorophyll, which is what gives those vegetables their green color. Cauliflower is obviously white. And this stuff is good for you, as in really good for you. Very low in calories. A cup is 25 calories, which is like nothing. Fiber, vitamin C. We could go on and on. A lot of people, when they're diagnosed with cancer, first thing they run to are these cruciferous vegetables, broccoli in particular. You know, is it going to stop you from getting cancer? I sincerely doubt it, but it's pretty delicious in the meantime.
I'll tell you what else is delicious is this soup, which also has cauliflower in it.
It does. And it's a good moment to talk about the fact that these are quite interchangeable. You could do this soup with broccoli. It would obviously be a different color. So I wanted to use Indian spices. There's a lot of cauliflower cauliflower that pops up in Indian food. And I decided I would make a soup because I wrote a book about soup and I love to make soups. So this Indian spice cauliflower soup with coconut milk has fennel seed and fresh ginger and dry ginger, and cumin seed. And then that coconut milk, along with some vegetable stock or chicken stock. I mean, talk about a main course. I would eat that soup and be perfectly happy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And by the way, I would also like to know why I am unable to eat soup without spilling it on myself.
Wow, you didn't admit that, you know?
It's right, radio.
It's radio, right.
I want to ask about the texture of the soup.
Yes.
While Jeremy mops up. So it's obviously you've used like a Cuisinart or something.
Yeah, actually I used an immersion blender, which is one of my favorite tools because they're quite inexpensive. And what it means is that you make soup in one pot. You don't have to transfer it to the blender or the food processor, clean that out, then clean the pot, put it back in the pot. It's basically a very strong whisk on a stick that you plug in and it just blends it up, but it doesn't overblend it.
Right.
Sometimes people put things in Cuisinart and blenders, and they get so overblended that it's just a little bit too smooth. So, yeah, you're tasting some texture in there, and also the ginger.
We mustn't forget the broccoli is here.
We must not. So one of the things I discovered is that sometimes if you cut a vegetable in a different way, it leads you to a new texture and a new dish. So broccoli they're florets, and they are generally separated and steamed or sautéed or stir-fried. I decided to cut the broccoli whole into thin slices with the stem as well, because the stem is also delicious. So it's almost like a thin steak, and I steamed it for a minute and sautéed it again with garlic, and then hot Italian sausage, and tossed it with penne or your favorite shape pasta, little Parmesan cheese, another quick go-to dinner.
And mine's without the sausage. And it's
you could
meal.
Go either way. Absolutely.
I just want to say, we were talking in the beginning about if you're just boiling your vegetables. I have these memories of my grandmother's apartment and you could
smell
boiled vegetables. And that's a nice memory, but you don't want that.
Is that a nice memory?
Yeah, just, you know, it's of grandma. But you don't want that smell.
Well,
you know?
It's not even the smell. It's the texture. Too, by steaming them lightly, you want to leave what the Italians call al dente, or a little bit of bite.
Yeah.
And we will put all of these recipes that Kathy's been talking about at our website, hereandnow.org. Go for it, especially the soup.
It will
so
crash.
Delicious.
The website will crash.
As always. Kathy, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.